So I want you to picture the year 2019, right?
Oh boy. I think I know where this is going.
Yeah, you probably do. So there's this massive, heavily hyped co-working real estate company, and they are preparing to go public.
Right, the infinite kombucha on tap era.
Exactly. And private markets have assigned this company a staggering valuation, like $37 billion.
Which is just, I mean, an absurd number for a company leasing office space.
Completely absurd. And Wall Street banks are fighting tooth and nail to underwrite the IPO. But then the S-1 prospectus drops.
And people finally had to read it.
Right. Analysts are actually reading the fundamental cash flows, you know, the required discount rates, and they see these insane adjusted earnings metrics that the company basically created out of thin air.
Community adjusted EBITDA, I think they called it.
Yes. Total nonsense metrics. And within weeks, that $47 billion valuation just evaporates. The IPO is pulled, and the company is effectively on life support.
Because that catastrophic mispricing happened, the second people stopped relying on mathematical reality, and started relying entirely on hype.
Exactly. And before we jump into how to avoid that exact trap yourself, a quick shout out to Cert Fuel.
Oh, yeah.
If you're prepping for the Series 66, which you are, if you're listening to this, they have a full course with adaptive quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real test. So definitely check them out at certfuel.com.
It's a lifesaver, honestly.
It really is. So that $47 billion illusion we just talked about, that is our starting point today.
Right?
Welcome to this deep dive into equity valuation factors. Our mission today is figuring out what a stock is actually fundamentally worth so you can lock in these concepts and crush the exam.
Yeah, we're basically pulling apart the secret languages that professional analysts use to price companies.
And the stakes for the exam here, I mean, they go way beyond just vocabulary, right?
Oh, absolutely. The Series 66 is not just going to ask for a textbook definition of a formula. They don't care if you just memorized it.
Right.
The exam expects you to know precisely which valuation approach fits which specific corporate scenario. And more importantly, what happens to the valuation when the underlying assumptions change?
Like when interest rates move or growth slows down.
Exactly. Memorizing the formulas without grasping the underlying mechanics is just a guaranteed way to fall into the traps they set. So today is really about the why.
The why is huge for me. If I don't know why a rule exists, my brain just deletes it.
Totally. Like, why do we use a rigid dividend formula for a century-old utility company, but then we rely on highly sensitive cash flow projections for a brand new software developer?
Right, they're completely different animals. So, to anchor these abstract math concepts in reality, I want to introduce you, the listener, to our recurring cast of characters for this deep dive.
I love these guys.
Yeah, they help so much. If you can picture these three distinct investors in your head whenever you face a valuation question, the exam becomes exponentially easier.
It really does. So who is first?
First up, we have chart-obsessed Charlie.
Classic Charlie.
Right. Picture a guy in a dark room, illuminated entirely by the glow of like six computer monitors.
Probably drinking his fourth energy drink.
Oh, guaranteed. Charlie is a day trader. He only looks at squiggly lines, heat maps, and volume bars on a screen.
Yeah.
He couldn't care less what a company actually manufactures or sells, and he never, ever reads an annual report. He just watches price momentum.
Right. And then, contrasting with our next guy, Dividend Dave. Dave is a conservative, retired investor who actually still reads physical newspapers on his porch.
Probably drinking sweet tea.
Exactly. He loves boring, mature, hyper-stable utility companies and consumer-stable brands. He doesn't care about the daily stock price fluctuations at all.
Because why would he?
Right, because his entire investment philosophy is based on getting a reliable, physical check in the mail every single quarter.
He just wants that cash flow.
He likes his portfolio to be as predictable as the sunrise.
Okay, so we've got Charlie, we've got Dave, and finally we have tech bro Timmy.
Oh, Timmy.
Timmy is a venture-backed startup founder. He's always wearing a branded corporate fleece vest, you know the type.
Standard uniform in Silicon Valley.
Exactly. His cloud computing company generates massive amounts of cash, but he reinvests every single penny back into aggressive growth.
Yeah, he's obsessed with capturing total addressable market share.
He loves that phrase, total addressable market. And his company has never paid a dividend, and according to Timmy, it never will.
Because to Timmy, paying a dividend means he ran out of ideas for how to grow the business.
Right. It's almost like an insult to him. So, Charlie the chart guy, Dave the dividend guy, and Timmy the growth and cash flow guy. Keeping the philosophies of these three characters completely separated in your mind is like the master key to unlocking this whole unit on the exam.
It really is. Which brings us to section one, the Great Divide.
The Great Divide.
Before we even touch a calculator today, we have to understand the two deeply opposed religions of the stock market.
Technical analysis versus fundamental analysis.
Exactly. And these aren't just, you know, different formulas. They are entirely different worldviews about how information is processed by the market.
So where does this philosophical split actually begin?
It begins with a concept known as the efficient market hypothesis.
EMOH.
Right. The core idea behind technical analysis, so this is chart-obsessed Charlie's domain, is the assumption that the market is ruthlessly efficient.
Like nothing gets past it.
Nothing. Technical analysts believe that the second a piece of news breaks, whether it's an earnings report, some macroeconomic data release, or like a massive scandal involving the CEO, millions of algorithms and traders instantly buy and sell based on that news.
Baking its impact into the stock's price within literally milliseconds.
Precisely.
So if you genuinely believe that all public information is instantly reflected in the current stock price, then spending your weekend reading a company's balance sheet is a complete waste of time.
It's totally pointless to Charlie.
The price on the screen already accounts for every single number on that balance sheet. That is exactly why Charlie ignores the fundamentals. He focuses entirely on answering one single question. When do I trade?
Right. The technical analyst studies past market data strictly historical price movements and trading volume to forecast future price direction.
They're looking for patterns, right?
Yeah, behavioral patterns driven by human psychology and supply and demand imbalances. They do not care if the company makes life-saving medical devices or, you know, pet rocks.
Pet rocks. I love it.
They just care about the momentum of the herd.
Okay, let's use an analogy to really highlight this contrast, because it's wild when you think about it.
Mm.
Imagine you're trying to pick a restaurant for dinner in a neighborhood you've never visited.
Okay, I'm hungry. Let's do it.
The fundamental analysis approach is walking inside the restaurant, asking for the menu, interviewing the head chef about their culinary training.
Demanding to see the health inspector's most recent report.
Exactly. You're in the kitchen, auditing their ingredient supply chain to ensure they buy quality produce. You are determining the underlying quality of the establishment.
Which takes a lot of time.
A ton of time. But technical analysis, on the other hand, it requires none of that diligence.
No. Charlie just stands across the street, sees a massive line of people wrapping around the block, and concludes that a long line implies high demand.
A long line. Must be good. I'm buying a spot in line.
Right. He doesn't even know what cuisine they serve. He is just trading on the visible momentum of the crowd.
So, to summarize, the fundamental analyst is trying to figure out what to buy. Value identification. The technical analyst is trying to figure out when to get in line. Market timing.
And this brings us to a massive, massive exam trap.
Oh, highlight this. Bold it. Put a star next to it.
Seriously, because technical analysts believe the current price already reflects all known information, they do not believe in the concept of a hidden intrinsic value.
Wait, really? Not at all.
Not at all. Intrinsic value is the true underlying mathematical worth of a company, which fundamental analysts believe can occasionally differ wildly from the current market price.
Right. Like if the market is completely irrational and panicking over some short-term news, a fundamental analyst might calculate that a stock trading at $20 a share actually has an intrinsic value of $50.
Exactly. They believe the market is mispricing the asset, which gives them a buying opportunity.
But Charlie doesn't buy that.
No. Charlie doesn't believe the market is ever wrong in a way that fundamental analysis can uncover. For him, the price is just the price.
So here is the trap. If you see a question on the Series 66 that pairs the phrase intrinsic value with technical analysis, what do?
You cross off that answer choice immediately.
Instantly. Technical analysts do not calculate intrinsic value, ever.
Never.
Okay, time to test this directly. I am going to ask a question, and I want you, the listener, to answer it out loud or in your head before we reveal it. Ready?
Let's do it.
If a portfolio manager is reading through a company's quarterly debt obligations to decide if the stock is a good long-term hold, which analytical method are they using? Fundamental.
Yes, fundamental. They are looking at the health inspector score. They are inside the restaurant.
Right. Now let's zoom in on section two, chart-obsessed Charlie and his technical tools. What exactly is Charlie analyzing on those six monitors, if he isn't looking at debt obligations or profit margins?
Well, the Series 66 requires you to recognize specific technical indicators so you can correctly categorize them. The foundational tool in technical analysis is the moving average.
Okay, moving average. Break that down.
So stock prices are highly volatile, right?
Mm-hmm.
They bounce around erratically every single day due to random noise. A moving average takes the closing prices over a specific rolling time frame, like, say, the last 50 days or 200 days, and averages them out.
Creating a smooth trend line overlaid on the chart.
Exactly. It filters out the daily static so you can see the actual direction of the trend.
Okay, but I want to push on that. A simple average just treats every single day equally right. But if I'm Charlie and I'm trying to time a trade today, I'd probably care a lot more about what the stock did yesterday than what it did like 199 days ago. Doesn't a simple moving average create a massive lag?
It does, which is why the exam might distinguish between a simple moving average and an exponential moving average.
Okay, what's the difference?
The exponential moving average applies mathematically heavier weights to the most recent trading days. So it reacts much faster to sudden price shocks.
Give me an example.
Sure. Let's say a company suddenly reports terrible earnings and the stock tanks 20% in one day.
Ouch.
Right. A 200-day simple moving average will barely budge because that one bad day is diluted by 199 other days. But the exponential moving average, it will aggressively hook downward, alerting Charlie to the sudden shift in momentum.
That distinction is crucial. And regardless of which one he uses, Charlie is looking for crossovers, right?
Yes, crossovers are huge. If the short-term 50-day average crosses above the long-term 200-day average, Charlie sees that as a massive bullish signal to buy.
The golden cross, they call it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It means the recent momentum is accelerating past the historical trend.
Okay, what else is in his toolkit?
The next concepts are support and resistance levels. And these are rooted purely in human psychology.
I love this one. Think of a stock price like a bouncing ball trapped inside a room. Support is the floor.
Right.
It's a specific price level where, historically, the stock stops falling because buyers suddenly rush in. Let's say a stock keeps dropping to $100, and every single time it hits $100, the market decides it's too cheap to ignore.
So the buying pressure acts as a physical floor, supporting the price.
Exactly. So what's resistance?
Resistance is the ceiling. When that bouncing ball rockets upward and hits, say, $150, sellers suddenly rush in.
But why? Why always at 150?
Because of the psychology of bag holders.
Oh, the bag holders.
Yeah. Imagine investors who bought at 150 a year ago, only to watch the stock crash to 100. They have been agonizing over their paper losses for months.
Losing sleep.
Totally. So the second the stock finally claws its way back up to 150, they desperately sell just to break even and escape the trade.
Just let me out alive.
Exactly. And that massive wall of sell orders creates a ceiling that resists further upward movement.
So Charlie is just watching the ball bounce between the $100 floor and the $150 ceiling, placing his trades based on those boundaries. He buys near support and sells near resistance.
Right. And he also uses relative strength, which measures how a specific stock is performing compared to a broader benchmark.
Like the S&P 500.
Exactly. So if the S&P 500 is down 3% on a particularly brutal trading day, but a specific cybersecurity stock is actually up 1%.
Oh, then that stock is demonstrating tremendous relative strength.
Exactly. It is absorbing all that macroeconomic selling pressure and still rising. Technical analysts actively hunt for high relative strength because it indicates underlying institutional accumulation.
Like big banks are quietly buying it up.
Yes.
Okay, let's talk about the ultimate lie detector in this whole process. Volume.
Oh, volume is everything.
It really is. Volume is the actual number of shares changing hands during a given period. I always like to think of price movement as the claim a stock is making and volume as the evidence required to back up that claim in court.
That's a great way to put it. Volume validates the trend. Let's go back to the bouncing ballroom. Suppose the stock finally pushes through that $150 resistance ceiling. It hits $152. Charlie sees a breakout on his chart.
Buy signal.
Well, hold on. The immediate exam trap here is assuming every breakout is actionable. A price breakout means absolutely nothing if the trading volume is unusually low.
So if the price breaks through the ceiling, but only a few thousand shares were traded, that's a weak, fragile signal.
Exactly. It just means a few retail day traders happen to push the price up in a quiet market. There is no heavy institutional money supporting the move. The second a large hedge fund decides to sell, that false breakout will collapse instantly.
It's a fake out.
But if the price smashes through resistance and the volume is completely massive, like millions of shares trading, doubling or tripling the average daily volume.
Then that high volume proves institutional conviction. It confirms the new upward trend is legitimate.
Yes, the Series 66 rule is ironclad here. High volume confirms the price trend. Low volume weakens the price trend.
High confirms, low weakens. Got it.
Okay, time for a quick pattern interrupt.
Let's hear it.
I want you to consider a wild statistic. In modern markets, something like 70 to 80% of all trading volume isn't even driven by humans anymore.
It's all algorithms.
Right. It's computers trading with other computers in microseconds. So when Charlie is analyzing volume, he's largely analyzing the footprints of supercomputers. Just keep that reality in mind when you think about how fast these technical indicators move today.
That is wild.
Okay, now, listener, shake out your shoulders, take a deep breath. We are entirely done with squiggly lines. We are kicking chart-obsessed Charlie out of the room.
See ya, Charlie. We are putting on our thickest accounting glasses, and we are finally walking inside the restaurant to audit the chef. Welcome to Section 3, Fundamental Analysis.
And this transition from technical to fundamental is a complete paradigm shift. We are no longer trying to time the emotional swings of the market.
Two more bouncing balls.
Right. We are attempting to uncover the intrinsic value of the business itself. Is this company a well-oiled, efficient compounder of wealth, or is it a bloated bureaucracy hiding behind a slick marketing campaign?
And to answer that, fundamental analysts rip apart the balance sheet and the income statement.
They use financial ratios to translate millions of rows of accounting data into digestible, comparable metrics.
And the exam heavily tests your ability to interpret these ratios. So let's start with the undisputed heavyweight champion. The P-E ratio, or price to earnings.
The most famous ratio of all time.
Exactly. The formula is simple. The current market price of one share divided by the earnings per share. But what does it actually tell us?
The P-E ratio tells an investor exactly how much they are paying for one single dollar of the company's earnings.
Okay, give me some numbers.
So if stock trades at $100 a share, and the company generates $5 in profit for every share.
100 divided by 5.
Right. The P-E ratio is 20. You are essentially paying $20 up front to buy $1 of current earning power.
Okay, but here is where I see people get completely tangled up. If I am a value investor and I'm hunting for bargains and I scan the market and find a stock with a PE ratio of 3, meaning I only have to pay $3 to buy a dollar of earnings, I mean, I should back up the truck and buy it immediately, right? Like, it's objectively cheap.
And that assumption is one of the most dangerous value traps in finance. And the exam will absolutely test you on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. A P-E ratio in complete isolation tells you nothing actionable. A severely lean P-E ratio does not automatically indicate an undervalued bargain.
Wait, why not? If I'm paying less for the earnings, isn't that mathematically superior?
It would be, if earnings were guaranteed to remain stable forever. But a plummeting stock price often precedes plummeting earnings. Let's say the market suddenly realizes a company's core product is entirely obsolete.
Imagine a company manufacturing fax machines in the modern era.
Perfect example. Investors will dump the stock. The price crashes. But because the historical earnings from last year, when they still sold a few fax machines, still look okay, the crashing price makes the P-E ratio drop to 3 or 4.
So it looks cheap on a screener.
It looks very cheap, but it's not cheap. The market is just correctly pricing in the reality that next year's earnings are going straight to zero.
Wow. Okay. So you are buying a dollar of past earnings for $3, but you might actually be paying $3 for 10 cents of future earnings.
Precisely the mechanic. And this brings up the critical distinction between trailing PE and forward PE.
Break that down.
Trailing PE uses the earnings from the last 12 months. It is historically accurate, but backward looking. Forward PE uses Wall Street's estimated earnings for the next 12 months. Mm. So if a company has a trailing PE of 10, but a forward PE of 50, what does that tell you?
It means analysts expect their profits to absolutely collapse next year.
Exactly. You always have to contextualize the ratio. You must compare a company's PE to its specific industry peers or its own historical averages. You cannot compare the PE of an artificial intelligence chip designer to the PE of a regional bank.
Right. Apples to oranges. Context is everything. Okay. Moving down the menu, let's look at PB, or the price to book ratio.
Right. This compares the market price of the stock to the company's book value per share.
And book value is basically the accounting equivalent of spare parts, right?
Exactly. If the company ceased operations today, liquidated every factory, sold every piece of inventory, and used that cash to pay off every single debt.
The leftover cash distributed to shareholders is the book value.
Yes. and value investors traditionally hunt for companies trading below their book value, so a PB ratio under 1.0.
Because if a company's spare parts are worth $50 a share, but the stock is trading at $40, you are theoretically buying a dollar's worth of hard assets for 80 cents.
Which is a great deal.
But let's apply the tech world reality to this. What about tech bro Timmy?
Timmy breaks this model entirely.
Right. Timmy's software company doesn't own factories or fleets of trucks or warehouses full of steel. His entire business consists of intellectual property, brand value, and code stored on an Amazon server, none of which show up neatly as hard assets on a balance sheet.
So his book value is basically zero.
Exactly. So how do we evaluate him with PB?
You don't. The application of PB there is flawed. Tech companies regularly trade at PB ratios of 15, 20, or even 50 because their value is derived from intangible assets and massive profit margins, not liquidation value.
So using price to book to evaluate a modern software company will result in terrible investment decisions.
Terrible. It is a metric best reserved for capital-intensive industries like manufacturing, railroads, or banking.
Makes sense. The next fundamental ratio is debt to equity, which is total liabilities divided by total shareholders' equity.
This is the financial leverage gauge. It tells us how much of the company's growth is being fueled by borrowed money versus money actually put up by the owners.
And leverage is a double-edged sword, right?
Oh, absolutely. In an environment where interest rates are 0%, carrying a lot of debt is practically free money to fuel expansion. It's great.
But if macroeconomic interest rates suddenly spike to 5 or 6%,
then a highly leveraged company with a massive debt-to-equity ratio will see its profits annihilated by skyrocketing interest payments. Fundamental analysts use this ratio to stress test the company's balance sheet against economic downturns.
Which leads perfectly into the current ratio, current assets divided by current liabilities. If debt to equity is about long-term structural leverage, the current ratio is purely about short-term survival.
The time frame here is strict, 12 months. Current assets are cash or things that will turn into cash within a year, like inventory. Current liabilities are the bills that must be paid within a year.
So if the ratio is exactly 1.0, they have exactly enough to pay their bills.
Right. But if the ratio is below 1.0, it means the company owes more money in the next 12 months than it actually has access to.
And that is a massive red flag. It doesn't matter if the company holds patents that will be worth billions in a decade. If they can't make payroll on Friday or pay the interest on their short-term debt next month, they face an immediate liquidity crisis.
Because survival today dictates the possibility of growth tomorrow.
Exactly. All right, finally, we arrive at ROE, return on equity, calculated as net income divided by shareholders' equity.
If you want to know how competent the CEO and management team actually are, you look at ROE. It measures efficiency.
I always think of equity as the capital investors handed to the CEO. So if we give a management team $10 million of equity and they only generate $100,000 in net income,
their ROE is 1%.
I could have put that money in a high yield savings account and done better. They are destroying value. But if they generate $2 million in net income,
then their ROE is 20%. They are a highly efficient wealth compounding machine.
Okay, so the analyst gathers all these metrics, the PE context, the leverage, the liquidity, the ROE, and attempts to build a comprehensive case for buying or selling.
But the Series 66 will test you on the specific sequencing an analyst uses to deploy this research. There are two distinct paths here, top down and bottom up.
Okay, let's visualize this as a funnel. The top down analyst starts at the widest possible opening of the funnel.
Right. They don't look at a single company's balance sheet yet. They start by analyzing the global macroeconomic climate.
Like, what is the Federal Reserve doing with interest rates? Is gross domestic product expanding? Is inflation cooling down?
Exactly. Only after determining that the macroeconomic environment is favorable do they narrow their focus.
So if the economy is booming, they ask which specific sector will benefit the most. Let's say technology.
Then they narrow further to an industry like semiconductor manufacturing.
And only at the very bottom of the funnel do they finally crack open the balance sheets to find the single best-run semiconductor company.
So the sequence is economy to sector to industry to company. That is top-down.
And the bottom-up analyst just flips the funnel upside down. They are entirely company-focused from the jump.
Yeah, they use a database screener to scan 10,000 public companies for strict fundamental metrics.
Like, show me companies with an ROE above 15%, a current ratio above 2, and low debt.
Right. And they find an obscure mid-cap company that perfectly fits the profile. Only after falling in love with the company's specific financials do they zoom out to check the industry dynamics.
And lastly, they glance at the macroeconomy just to ensure a massive recession isn't imminent. So that sequences company to industry to sector to economy.
A vital clarification for the exam here. Both top-down and bottom-up are strict forms of fundamental analysis.
That's a great point. They both use the fundamentals.
Yes. They both rely on financial health and economic data. They simply process the information in reverse order. Neither of them uses charts, and neither of them are technical analysis.
Okay, direct question time for the listener. You are sitting at the exam center. The question reads, an analyst screens for companies with a debt-to-equity ratio below 0.5 and a historical ROE exceeding 20% before evaluating the broader economic impact of interest rates. Which approach are they using?
Bottom-up.
Bottom-up, because they start with the company-specific metrics first.
Got it. So fundamental analysis tells us a company is healthy, efficient, and surviving. But health is an abstract concept. It doesn't give us a specific, mathematically precise dollar price target to place a trade on.
Right. Saying it's healthy doesn't tell me if I should buy it at $40 a share.
Exactly. To convert fundamental health into an intrinsic value price tag, we have to use mathematical modeling. Bring in Dividend Dave.
Welcome to Section 4.
Valuing the payout with the Dividend Discount Model, or DDM. This is where the theory of fundamental analysis collides with cold, hard math. As we established, Dividend Dave loves mature utility companies.
He intends to hold his shares until he literally dies.
Right. He does not care about the daily stock price because he is never going to sell the stock to realize a capital gain.
Let's follow the logic of that behavior. If you buy an asset and you hold it literally forever, the only actual cash that will ever hit your bank account from that investment is the quarterly dividend check.
Therefore, the pure intrinsic mathematical value of that stock today must be exactly equal to the value of all those future dividend checks added together.
But, and this is a big but, we can't just add them up using basic addition.
No, because of a foundational finance concept, the time value of money.
Right. A dollar handed to you 10 years from now is intrinsically worth less than a dollar handed to you today. Why? Because if I hand you a dollar today, you can put it in a treasury bond yielding 5%. By year 10, it's worth a lot more than a dollar.
So if I promise to give you a dollar in 10 years, we have to mathematically shrink or discount that future dollar to figure out what it is equivalent to in today's money.
So the dividend discount model calculates the present value of an infinite stream of future dividends. And the specific variant tested on the Series 66 is called the Gordon Growth Model.
It assumes the company's dividend will grow at a constant, steady percentage rate forever.
Let's look at the actual formula, and we will walk through it carefully. The intrinsic value equals D1 divided by the quantity of R minus G. Let me translate the algebra. D1 is the expected dividend payment for next year.
Next year. That's critical.
The R is the investor's required rate of return, which is the minimum yield they demand for taking on the risk of the stock. And the G is the constant annual growth rate of the dividend.
Let's run a concrete example to cement the mechanics. Dividend Dave is evaluating a blue chip utility stock. The exam question states the stock currently pays an annual dividend of $2.
Okay, $2.
Dave estimates the company will increase its dividend by 5% every year, forever. And because Dave is conservative, he requires a 10% rate of return on his capital.
Step one is where thousands of test takers lose a point. We have to identify the numerator, D1. The scenario said the stock currently pays a $2 dividend. That is D0 the dividend right now today.
Right. And the formula explicitly requires D1, next year's dividend. If you plug $2 into the formula, you will get the wrong answer. And I guarantee that wrong answer will be sitting there as choice A to trick you.
So how do we find D1?
You must inflate today's dividend by the growth rate to find next year's dividend. You take the $2 current dividend and multiply it by 1 plus the growth rate. The growth rate is 5% or 0.05.
So you multiply $2 by 1.005.
Right. That equals $2.10. Next year's expected dividend, D1, is $2.10.
Okay. Now we have our numerator. Let's build the denominator, which is R minus G. Dave's required return, R, is 10%. Or 0.10. The growth rate G is 5% or 0.05.
We subtract the growth from the required return. 0.10 minus a 0.05 leaves us with 0.05.
Okay. And to find the final intrinsic value, divide the numerator by the denominator. We divide $2.10 by 0.05.
And if you execute that division, you arrive at exactly $42.
Wow. So according to the rigid mathematics of the Gordon Growth Model, the absolute true intrinsic value of this utility stock is $42.
Exactly.
Now, let's make this actionable for Dave. Direct question for the listener. Dave's model spits out an intrinsic value of $42. Dave opens his brokerage app and sees the stock is currently trading on the open market for $35. What is the required action?
Buy the stock.
Buy it. It is severely undervalued. The math says it's worth $42, but the market is foolishly offering it for $35. You are buying a $42 asset at a discount.
Conversely, if it was trading at $50, Dave wouldn't touch it because the market has overvalued the dividend stream.
Right. Now, the exam will also test your understanding of the mathematical limitations of this formula. Let's look closely at the denominator again, R minus G.
What happens if the company is growing so incredibly fast that its dividend growth rate, G, is actually higher than Dave's required return, R? Say Dave requires a 10% return, but the company is raising its dividend by 15% a year.
Well, 0.10 minus 0.15 gives us a negative 0.05 in the denominator. You divide a positive dividend by a negative denominator, and the formula outputs a negative intrinsic value.
And a stock cannot be worth negative dollars.
Right. The entire mathematical foundation of the Gordon growth model shatters. The formula only works if the required rate of return is strictly greater than the growth rate.
That is a fundamental limitation, and it brings up an even more obvious flaw in the model. What do we do about tech bro Timmy?
Oh man, Timmy ruins this model entirely. Timmy's startup generates massive cash flows, revenue is doubling every year, and they are dominating their industry. But Timmy has sworn a blood oath to never, ever pay a dividend.
He reinvests every cent into server space and hiring engineers.
If we force Timmy's company into the DDM formula, the dividend is zero. D1 is zero. Zero divided by anything is zero. The model dictates that Timmy's multi-billion dollar tech empire is completely worthless.
Which illustrates the absolute boundaries of DDM. It is a highly specialized tool designed explicitly for mature, stable, blue-chip companies with a long history of predictable dividend payouts.
It is completely useless for growth stocks, venture capital startups, or any business that prefers to reinvest capital rather than distribute it to shareholders.
So if the DDM is useless for Timmy, we have to find another way to price his startup, or else we are flying blind.
Which means we need to upgrade our toolkit. We are moving to Section 5, the ultimate valuation tool. The discounted cash flow model, or DCF.
If the dividend discount model is a surgical scalpel used for one specific type of procedure, the discounted cash flow model is the entire Swiss Army knife.
It does everything.
DCF values a security as the present value of all expected future cash flows, regardless of what the company decides to do with those cash flows.
Let's use the tree analogy because this visual perfectly captures the difference between the two models. Think of an entire business as an apple tree.
Okay, apple tree.
Using the dividend discount model is like trying to measure the total financial value of that tree by only counting the apples that randomly detach and drop to the ground for you to pick up. The dropped apples are the dividends. If the tree never drops an apple, DDM says the tree has no value.
But the reality is a healthy tree has tremendous inherent value, regardless of whether it drops its fruit today.
Exactly. A DCF model measures the value of the entire tree. It measures the apples, sure, but it also measures the value of the timber in the trunk, the shade provided by the leaves, and the future growth potential of the root system.
ECF looks at all the cash the company generates, specifically free cash flow. It doesn't matter if Timmy hoards that cash in a corporate bank account or uses it to build a new data center. The cash exists, the company generated it, and therefore it has value. DCF prices the entire timber of the business.
The flexibility of DCF is why it is the gold standard on Wall Street, but that flexibility comes at a severe cost.
Complexity. A DCF model requires the analyst to make a series of highly sensitive forecasts.
Let's walk through the mechanics of how an analyst actually builds one. Step one involves projecting the company's free cash flows into the future, typically over a 5 to 10 year forecast period.
The analyst has to sit down and make educated guesses about what Timmy's revenue growth will be in year 3, what his operating margins will be in year 6, and how much he will have to spend on capital expenditures in year 8.
That is an enormous amount of forecasting, and it's super prone to error.
It is. Once the analyst has mapped out a decade of expected cash flows, they move to step 2, selecting the discount rate. This is the rate used to bring all those future cash flows back to their present value today.
And the discount rate is heavily determined by the perceived risk of the investment. Often, analysts use a metric called the weighted average cost of capital, or WACC, which blends the cost of the company's debt and the cost of its equity.
The relationship between risk and the discount rate is one of the most critical concepts on the exam. It operates like a seesaw.
Okay, a seesaw. Let's test that. If an analyst looks at Timmy's startup and decides it is highly speculative and incredibly risky, how does that affect the discount rate they choose?
Higher risk mandates a higher discount rate. Investors demand greater compensation for taking on uncertainty.
And what happens to the final intrinsic valuation of the company when you apply a higher discount rate?
The valuation drops. This is the seesaw effect you must memorize. When the discount rate goes up, the present value goes down. Future cash flows are penalized heavily by a high discount rate, shrinking their value in today's dollars.
Conversely, if a company is deemed incredibly safe, the analyst uses a lower discount rate, which results in a higher present valuation. Higher risk equals lower valuation.
Exactly. Okay, so step one, project 10 years of cash flow. Step two, select a discount rate based on the risk profile. Step three is the actual discounting math, bringing every single future year back to year zero and summing them up.
But there is a massive reality check here regarding the time horizon, the terminal value.
Right, because a company doesn't just cease to exist after the 10-year forecast period. The analyst has to calculate a terminal value, which represents the present value of all cash flows from year 11 to infinity, assuming a steady, modest growth rate.
And this is exactly where the vulnerability of DCF gets exposed. Because you are forecasting out to infinity, the math gets extremely sensitive. In many DCF models, the terminal value accounts for 60, 70, or even 80% of the entire valuation.
Which leads to the fundamental limitation of DCF, the computer science principle of garbage in, garbage out.
Meaning
if an overly optimistic analyst tweaks the terminal growth rate assumption from, say, 2% to 3%, that tiny 1% change in an assumption about a decade from now can artificially double the present value of the company today.
Wow. So DCF models are highly susceptible to analyst bias. You can essentially make a DCF model output whatever intrinsic value you want just by slightly altering the discount rate or the growth assumptions.
It's the illusion of precision. It looks like hard math, but it's built on a foundation of educated guesses.
All right, let's do a rapid-fire side-by-side comparison. The exam loves to test your ability to differentiate these two models. I will state a scenario or feature, and you identify whether it applies to the dividend discount model or the discounted cash flow model.
I'm ready.
Best suited for a mature, century-old utility company with a reliable payout history.
BDM.
Best suited for a high-growth biotech firm that reinvests all its capital into research and development.
DCF.
Utilizes a rigid formula that completely breaks if the required return is lower than the growth rate.
BDM.
Is heavily sensitive to analyst assumptions regarding capital expenditures and profit margins 10 years in the future.
DCF.
Let's throw in a major exam trap right here. An analyst wants to determine the intrinsic value of a 10-year corporate bond based on its semi-annual coupon payments and the final principal return. Which model should they use?
DCF. The exam will try to convince you. DCF is only for tech stocks. It is not. DCF can value literally any asset that produces a measurable stream of future cash flows.
You use DCF to value bonds.
Yes. You use DCF to value a commercial real estate property based on projected rental income. It is universally applicable, whereas DDM is exclusively for dividend-paying equities.
That distinction is paramount. All right. We have covered an immense amount of ground. We started on the street looking at technical volume patterns. We moved inside the restaurant to audit the fundamental accounting ratios. We picked up the dropped apples at the dividend model. And finally, we valued the entire timber of the business using discounted cash flows.
That's a lot to take in.
It is. Let's transition to the outro. I am going to run through a high-energy recap of the most critical, highly testable takeaways from this unit. This is your mental cheat sheet. Lock these in.
Go for it.
Number one, technical analysis. This is chart-obsessed, Charlie. It relies entirely on charts, volume, moving averages, and relative strength. It attempts to answer when to trade. It is built on the assumption that all known information is already priced into the stock. Therefore, technical analysts never, ever calculate intrinsic value. And remember, high volume confirms a breakout. Low volume renders it meaningless.
Perfect. Number two, fundamental analysis. This relies on the balance sheet and income statement to determine what to buy by uncovering a company's intrinsic value. We use ratios. Context is key. A low PE ratio could be a bargain, or it could be a value trap indicating collapsing future earnings. Remember the funnel. Top-down starts with the global macroeconomy and funnels down to the company. Bottom-up starts with screening company financials and works outward. Both are strict forms of fundamental analysis.
Number three, The dividend discount model, specifically Gordon Growth. This is for Dividend Dave. It values a stock strictly on the present value of its future dividend stream. The biggest exam trap. The formula demands D1, next year's expected dividend. If the test gives you today's dividend, you must multiply it by 1 plus the growth rate first. The formula fails entirely for non-dividend payers, and it shatters mathematically if the growth rate exceeds the required return.
Number 4. Discounted cash flow. This is for Tech Bro Timmy. It values an asset based on all expected future cash flows, making it perfect for non-dividend paying growth stocks, corporate bonds, and real estate. Remember the seesaw of risk. Assigning a higher risk profile requires using a higher discount rate, which severely lowers the present intrinsic valuation of the asset. DCF is incredibly flexible, but deeply vulnerable to garbage in, garbage out assumption errors.
That is the foundation of equity valuation.
We have spent this entire deep dive attempting to calculate intrinsic value. We've scrutinized accounting ratios, we've executed Gordon Growth algebra, we've mapped out complex 10-year DCF cash flow projections, all in pursuit of discovering whether the current market price is statistically wrong.
Right.
But I want to leave you with a final provocative thought that challenges everything we just did.
Oh, lay it on me.
Ask yourself this. If you build a flawless fundamental model and discover a wildly undervalued cash flowing machine of a company, but the broader market completely ignores that company for 10 straight years, and its stock price remains completely stagnant, does its intrinsic value actually matter?
Oh, that's heavy.
Or is chart-obsessed Charlie ultimately right? In a marketplace dictated by human emotion and supply and demand, is perception the only reality that actually pays?
It is a philosophical tension that literally defines the market. Keep that tension in the back of your mind as you navigate the math.
The murky psychological waters of valuation.
Good luck on the Series 66. You have the tools to completely dissect these questions now. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.